Welcome to The Gauge, a new podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Your host today is Green Gauge's CEO, Sean Kiernan, who is in conversation with financial services and technology lawyer, Lee Schneider. Lee is currently General Counsel at Ava Labs, a leading blockchain software company, and is also an originating member of the Digital Pound Foundation. Sean and Lee will discuss what we mean by a token. What are the different types of tokens that exist? How do different jurisdictions classify tokens? And is there a need for greater harmonisation? And how will the arrival of central bank digital currencies affect the digital asset market?
Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. Really delighted to have you. Obviously, Helen's given a brief background on yourself, but if you'd like to say a few words of what you're up to before we dig into the Q&A.
Yeah, this is great. I really appreciate you inviting me on here, and there's a lot to talk about, so always happy to yak away. I've been a financial services and technology lawyer for 30 years. I have worked both in law firms and in-house roles. My current in-house role is as the general counsel of Ava Labs, which is a blockchain technology company, blockchain software company. And I've been sort of generally making a nuisance of myself around the blockchain space for the last 6 years or so, both as an outside lawyer and as an in-house lawyer. So lots to learn and lots to do. And it feels like there's lots more to learn and lots more to do every day. So keeping myself busy.
Well, one of the things I was really fascinated about in just discussing with you earlier and reading some of your work and contributions is we're so early in the game, if you will, of kind of definition setting of what are tokens and how can a blockchain kind of actually work with traditional names and ideas. And I'd be super interested to hear. I understand you've been working on a paper, a sensible tokenization framework. If you could just talk to some of the high-level ideas you're thinking about and how tokenization of assets is being represented in media, policy, and legal circles, and some of your thoughts around that.
Absolutely. And Sean, I think you hit the nail right on the head when you say that the definitions are still very much being formed. We see lots of reports coming out of governmental and supergovernmental agencies that still don't spend time trying to come up with some of the basic definitions that we need in connection with thinking about crypto assets. And so one of the motivations behind my sensible token classification system was to try to just lay out at a high level what tokenization means. That is to say, what's going on when you tokenize an asset to your question in particular. And so as I got to thinking about it over the course of the last several years, it became clear to me that most people are still focused on blockchain tokens as being cryptocurrencies, even though we've moved well beyond that. And I think that's a function of the fact that Bitcoin and Ether are A, the two most popular crypto assets, and B, are the two of the earliest crypto assets. And the second reason I think it's been sort of focused that way is because most people outside of the blockchain space are not seeing the breadth of what's going on in blockchain. And so they're used to considering assets in a very narrow sense and thinking about all assets as financial instruments, all crypto assets as financial instruments. So my sensible classification system sought to perhaps dispel some of those mythologies. When I talk about this at events and whatnot, I like to give three contrasting examples of crypto assets. One is Bitcoin. The second one is the Beeple artwork that sold for $69 million last year as an NFT, a non-fungible token. And the third one is my personal favorite, the Fart Jar NFTs, which some reality star in the U.S. is popularizing based on, I don't even know what, but the backstory is incredibly funny, and I urge all of your listeners to go read it. And I think those really highlight the differences of what's going on with tokenization. Bitcoin is a token, just like the Beeple Art NFT was a token, just like the fart jars are a token. And yet the functions and features, if you will, the characteristics of those tokens are incredibly different, and the purposes for which they are created are incredibly different, and the reasons that people might acquire and use them are incredibly different. And so from my perspective, we need to be focused on the characteristics of the token in order to figure out not just sort of legal and regulatory classification, but utilization and valuation, among other things. The last thing I'll say on this point is, when we look at other types of assets, we are always thinking about utilization first. What does that thing do? What is its purpose? How does it work? What's it for? And that helps us understand the valuation that people give to it. Although sometimes we humans give funny valuations to things that that exist out in the world. But also, the policies behind the laws and regulations that are made often flow from the nature of the asset that's involved. And so for me, that's why it was important to come up with a sensible token classification system to divide tokens into broad categories to help people think about what they are.
And that's a great introduction. I'm, of course, keen to read a little bit more about the third example you give. I'd love to hear, if you wouldn't mind, kind of for those three and maybe others as you see fit, if there is kind of a little bit of insight you could give our listeners to the sensible meta categories of tokens that you would see those examples fitting in.
Sure. So at a base level, the important thing to remember is that when we're talking about tokenization, what we're talking about is creating a digital representation of something. And so the question is, what have we created a digital representation of? And I tried to come up with some categories that I felt were broad enough that would get us started on the analysis. So the first category I came up with was physical asset tokens. That is to say, a token that's a digital representation of some physical asset in the world. And that physical asset could be anything. It could be wheat or gold, which are common commodities that trade in spot markets everywhere. Could also be sneakers, which are common commodities that trade in different markets. And sneakers is another good example to me, because sometimes you care which pair of sneakers you're getting. If you're buying a vintage pair of Air Jordans or Adidas or some other popular shoe, or the shoe may not be vintage, but it may be a limited run of that shoe, right? Then you really care about the ones that you got. Whereas if you're just buying some shoes to wear around town, you don't care which pair you got as long as you got the right size and color that you requested. So when we think about physical asset tokens, what the token does is it makes it just easier to trade that thing. And we already do that. We just don't think about it that much. So think about the difference between buying shoes online versus buying shoes in a store. When you buy shoes online, you're really just looking at digital representations of shoes. They could be incredibly detailed digital representations that include pictures and descriptions and reviews and all of the things that you might find on some very popular websites that sell shoes. When you're in the store, you're using your five senses. Well, maybe not all of your five senses. I don't often lick the shoes that I'm trying on, but you're using your physical senses to assess the shoes, including how they feel on your feet and what the fit is, which you can't do from a digital standpoint. But the point is, we have all these digital representations in our lives already. We've become very used to shopping for all kinds of physical goods online. And just saying that digital representation is a token as opposed to some other type of digital representation, to my mind, doesn't make any difference to the analysis that you're doing from a legal standpoint. Doesn't make any difference to the analysis that you're doing from a utilization or valuation standpoint. And so for physical asset tokens, really, it's just a new digital expression or representation of things that we've all been doing for the last many years. The next category that I came up with were services tokens. That is to say, tokens where you expect the delivery of some kind of a service as a result of exchanging the token for the service. One example for us lawyers could be a token that represents an hour of legal services or legal services in connection with a particular project, et cetera, et cetera. But an easier way to think about services tokens is really to think about performances, tickets to a performance, tickets to a show, tickets to a movie, et cetera, et cetera. There, you're expecting to receive that performance in exchange for the token, the ticket, for the performance. And again, as with the physical asset tokens, it's not clear to me why we should think of those tokens as being any different from any other form of a digital representation of tickets, for example. Then I move to intangible asset tokens. So what are intangible assets? I actually spent a long time thinking about this because I hadn't really thought about it before. And the easiest way that I can think of to describe intangible assets is to say that they are human ideas. And what do I mean by that? Well, when we think of, for example, shares of stock, a share of stock is not a physical thing, but it's a representation of a human idea that you can own part of another human idea, a legal entity, through what we call shares of stock. Now, I know that that's not the only form of entity ownership, but let's just use that because it's easiest. That's just a human idea. And over the course of time, people have been trying to figure out ways to express shares of stock in various formats so that it's clear who has ownership. And many folks who are a little bit older will remember literally physical shares of stock on paper certificates with all kinds of fancy designs and sometimes ribbons and seals and whatnot. And the process for transferring physical shares that way, the paper certificates, was a very arduous process because you had to establish that the bearer of the certificate was actually the person named on the certificate. And then you had to do the transfer, and there was a whole bunch of work that was necessary in there. And so what happened? Well, what happened was as computer technology got better, there became digital representations of shares of stock, typically at a depository like the Depository Trust Company here in the US. And that basically swapped out the physical piece of paper for a digital representation on the computers of the DTC. Did that change the character or nature of the stock? No, it just changed the form of the representation. And so, to my mind, again, when you have a share of stock represented on a blockchain, that is to say, tokenized, it's not clear to me why we need to have a wholly different set of rules with respect to that stock than the ones that we have with respect to the physical securities, the physical certificates, or the DTC-based certificates. Now, obviously, I'm being a little bit overbroad there because of the difference between paper and DTC and blockchain. That is to say, the differences in those technologies. Maybe there are tweaks around how things get treated for practical operational purposes that make sense. But when we think about the rights that are associated with the shares of stock, when we think about the legal entity that's issuing the shares of stock and the disclosures that we might want it to make, et cetera, that's where it's just not clear to me that there needs to be any difference. And then the last big category that I discuss, there's actually two more, but the last big one that I discuss is native DLT tokens. And these, to my mind, are tokens that do not exist without the blockchain and are an integral part of making the blockchain work. And it might be the layer one protocol blockchain, like Ethereum or Avalanche. It also might be a smart contract, right? Sometimes smart contracts cannot function without the associated token, depends on the structuring, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you look at these native DLT tokens, you say, well, actually, maybe something slightly different is happening here because of how integral they are to the functioning of the blockchain. Avalanche would not exist without a Vox. It needs a Vox to help secure the network and allow for the payments of gas, et cetera. Same thing with Ether and Ethereum. And so, because of that, what I might call unique relationship between the token and the blockchain, it seems like a different category is appropriate there. And then the last thing I tackle is stablecoins, mostly because they've been popular in the news, and there are some interesting things to say about stablecoins, but probably not on this podcast.
Really interesting and actually fascinating to rebase, as you say, sensible or pragmatic definitions around things that people already understand and work with. Which, to a certain extent, is a different approach, perhaps, than to what some different jurisdictions are taking as they define their own classifications. I'd be fascinated to hear kind of your thoughts on, are there any specific jurisdictions, if you're willing to venture, that might be on the right path, or any that you think are maybe needing a rethink of how they approach this emerging space?
A couple things. All jurisdictions are making a lot of policy choices here with regard to blockchain and crypto assets. And those policy choices are going to be important for the way people act going forward in the future. So I think coming to grips with good definitions of tokens, good definitions of which types of crypto assets are covered by which regulations that are being promulgated is absolutely critical. I don't think that most jurisdictions are thinking about tokenization of assets broadly enough to understand these categories that I've just outlined. If regulators and policymakers sort of don't come to grips with these differences, then and keep treating crypto assets as sort of a homogeneous asset class, then we lose all of what the basis of law has been for centuries. The example I like to give for common law jurisdictions is real estate law, real property law, is completely different than contract law. I think it's the same in the UK as it is in the US. And you, when you're in law school and you're a young lawyer and you're thinking, this makes no sense. Like, why should a contract related to real property have all of these different legal requirements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But then when you look back at the history of real property and the importance it played through the centuries, you understand why the law developed differently there, because there were different policy considerations than there were with regard to other types of commercial contracts. And the fact that property was central to people's wealth, was central to their business activities, their commercial activities, meant that it developed a different set of laws from ordinary contract laws, ordinary securities laws, et cetera, et cetera. And we should not lose that nuance. We should not lose that difference. I don't want, sneakers treated the same as stocks. I don't want fart jars treated the same as stocks. I don't want people's $69 million digital artwork NFT treated the same as a financial instrument, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want that treatment not just for regular commercial purposes, but I don't want it for anti-money laundering purposes. Anti-money laundering has typically focused on financial instruments, and yet we see it constantly going beyond those boundaries. And it's become a justification for all kinds of changes to the law, changes to privacy, et cetera, that maybe we need to take a step back and think about what those goals should be.
I think it's a particularly rich idea to think about the history of how laws have been established over the passage of time, and use that as a way to inform our current discussion that not just you and I are having, but many people are having indeed. In terms of then, say a common law jurisdiction and the idea of harmonization of definitions in what is a new framework in the world of crypto assets. How can one look to the past as a way to inform a discussion on an international scale? We hear of the EU as a regulatory superpower, a new expression. Do we look to the US and to say the EU or maybe even the UK as bulwarks of setting definitions and then people working towards them? What are some of the discussions happening there?
I think that's an excellent question, Sean, and I wish I had a really good answer for you there. Look, I think that there needs to be really deep thought here. I think, the UK Law Commission, by the way, I think has done some really good deep thinking about smart contracts, about whether or not digital assets are property. I love those reports that they've written on those topics. I know they have a consultation out there for another topic that I can't remember right now. And although I don't always agree with everything they say, and I am not a UK lawyer, an English lawyer, so I don't pretend to know as much about English law, but at least they are spending time pulling the strands together and trying to understand things. I do think some of that is happening in Europe with the market in crypto assets regulation, although I think that some of the pull from anti-money laundering regulation, funds transfer regulation in Europe is perhaps not as productive, because again, it seeks to homogenize all crypto assets rather than recognize their differences. I think in the US, President Biden's executive order was a great step in the right direction. It's going to, it did mandate quite a few federal regulatory agencies to do some deep thinking about crypto assets. And so I hope to be actively engaged with several of them as they try to move things forward. And there's also some interesting stuff happening in Asia. You know, most people forget that Japan had the first comprehensive crypto asset regulation all the way back in 2016. So they had spent a lot of time thinking about it. I don't necessarily agree because with how everything came out, because they tend to homogenize everything, but they are recognizing that there are different types of crypto assets now. And so I think the Japanese are an excellent place for us to look and collaborate, because they're trying to think intelligently about it. I think the same thing is true in Singapore. They're doing good work there. Australia's doing good work there. Again, I don't necessarily agree with everything, because I think the sensible token classification system is oftentimes somewhat more sensible than the way that they're thinking about things. Or maybe I should say, it would be sensible for them to take a look at it as a way to help inform the thinking that they're doing. The last thing I'll say is, look, it's really easy to just say, it's all crypto assets, we're just going to treat them all the same, right? And, you know, that's not been the history of how we've thought about assets. Typically, we've done the hard work of figuring out what categories assets fall into and regulating them according to their categories. But at the end of the day, if we make a decision for all purposes or for some purposes that it's a crypto asset and we're just going to label it as such and treat it the same for a bunch of purposes, I'm not necessarily opposed to that, as long as we go into it with our eyes open as to what the implications are. So if we want to hold Fartjar NFTs to the same standard as an issuance of stock by a company, then I think that's not a great idea, but I can understand why people would want to go in that direction. So if we're going to do it, though, we got to do it with our eyes open, because otherwise we're going to end up with very confused situation where if I buy a token representing vintage Air Jordans, it's going to be treated differently than if I look at if I buy Air Jordans through something that's not DLT or blockchain based.
Thank you. I think we could go on for a very long time and drill into this, but I think one thing which, as you referenced, being very topical these days, is CBDCs, and I think the sensible approach of looking to historic frameworks for definitions for, say, physical tokens or service tokens or virtual tokens. CBDCs are somewhat kind of they're slotting into the fiat world, but they're also something new. And I think I'd be very interested to hear your take about how they're playing into this overall, and any thoughts for what you think they might be doing to influence, say, the definition setting from a regulatory perspective.
So the reason that I did not include CBDCs in the sensible classification system is because it's not clear to me that many CBDCs will be tokenized digital currencies, right? So I think the jury is still out as to whether or not blockchain or other DLT technologies will be used for a central bank digital currency. I may think it's a really good idea for that to happen, but nobody's appointing me governor or chair of the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, or I'm certainly nobody's going to replace Christine Lagarde with me. But, you know, so I think the jury is still out on that question. And I'm really fascinated to see how different countries who implement a CBDC do it. One of the things that I like to say to people is there's good reasons why the central banks should just encourage the growth of stable coins. Maybe they want to impose some more regulation on some of the stable coin providers, but the stable coins do what a CBDC would do in terms of access for a broad swath of people without having to create all kinds of new government machinery and operations to do it. Now, that may not be the optimal result for a whole bunch of really good reasons. One of which is monetary policy through CBDC is probably a bit easier than monetary policy through stablecoins. But look, there are some really interesting things happening in the stablecoin space right now. The adoption of stablecoins has been huge. And maybe that's a really legitimate way for a variety of governments to think about digitizing, if you will, their currency. So to me, jury's still very much out here, and I'm really interested to see how different countries solve this question.
I think the next couple of years will be very rich to help us see how they are unfolding. I'd love to ask you, and for the listeners, where we could find a bit more information on your sensible token classification system.
Oh, sure. So actually, Chambers and Partners, which is a service that reviews lawyers, they have a fintech practice guide that they've been doing since 2019. And I asked them, and they were kind enough to publish the sensible token classification system as my opening introduction essay this year. I'm the contributing editor for the FinTech Practice Guide. And every year I do an opening essay. So they were kind enough to publish it this year. It just came out, so you can find it at the Chambers and Partners website. I'll send you the link if you want to post it with the podcast, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, I'm hoping that it gets out there more and more.
We'd be delighted to post the link. Thank you very much, Lee. It's been a pleasure seeing the beautiful Aurora Borealis behind you, and it's peaking. And also, I think I caught Mighty Mouse, the photo at the introduction, and also hearing your insights. So thank you very much for your time.
Really terrific. Sean, I really enjoyed our conversation. And as you can tell, I take this stuff incredibly seriously, but I also see a lot of the humor around the edges here. And I think not enough people are looking at the humor behind what's going on here in addition to all of the serious stuff. So hopefully we can encourage a little bit better sense of humor in these times of many other things going on in the world.
Fully agreed. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to The Gauge, Green Gauge's monthly podcast series. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our upcoming shows and keep up to date with the latest blockchain and digital asset analysis and thinking.